This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Bureau of the Fiscal Service within the U.S. Department of Treasury was formed by combining the Financial Management Service, FMS, and the Bureau of the Public Debt, BPD, which finances government operations, accounted for the resulting public debt, and provided financial and administrative services to federal agencies. The Financial Management Service supplied central payments and collections and deposit services for the federal government, overseeing a daily cash flow of over $89 billion, and prepared the financial statements of the federal government. How does the Fiscal Service transform the way the federal government manages its financials? What is the Fiscal Service doing to promote the financial integrity and operational efficiency of the federal government? How is it strengthening its financial management processes to realize efficiency, better transparency, and dependable accountability? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dave Liebrich, Commissioner of the Bureau of the Fiscal Service within the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Dave, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Roxanne Ulrich. Roxanne, as always, welcome.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here.
Dave, before we delve into specific initiatives and discuss in more detail the creation of your organization, I'd like to understand its current mission. What is the mission of Treasury's Bureau of the Fiscal Service, and what activities does your organization engage in?
Well, on October 7th of 2012, the Bureau of Public Debt and the Financial Management Service came together to form the Bureau of the Fiscal Service. And the Bureau of Fiscal Service has a very important mission. We make most of the government payments. We collect most of the money for the government. We account for the public debt, as well as report on the financial activity of the federal government. In addition, we do debt collection on behalf of federal agencies and provide shared services to over 188 customers.
How is the Bureau organized? What's the size of the budget, number of F2Es, and your geographical footprint?
We have an appropriated budget around $360 million, and we have employees in six locations located across America. We have a payment center in Kansas City and a payment center in Philadelphia. We have two debt collection centers, one in Austin, Texas, and one in Birmingham, Alabama. And the bulk of our operations are done in the Washington, D.C. area and Parkersburg, West Virginia.
How many folks work for you?
Around 3,600 employees.
David, I'd like to focus more on your specific responsibilities as the commissioner of the Bureau of Fiscal Service. Would you describe for us your duties and the areas under your purview and how your efforts, overall efforts, support the mission of the Department of the Treasury?
Well, as the commissioner of the Bureau, my major responsibility is to set strategic direction for the organization. And at the same time, I think any good leader in an organization needs to be very much focused on the operational ongoings of the organization and the people of the organization. So for me, I probably spend a fair amount of my time on the strategic, setting the direction for the organization, establishing the priorities, but also making sure that we're delivering on these very important functions that we do on a daily basis. You know, I mentioned the number of payments that we make, and every month we make payments to around roughly 80 million people. And these are people who are relying on their Social Security payments or their veterans' payments, and we call them lifeline payments. And so it's very important that those payments get made every month, on time, every time. And we take great pride in that. And I think as we look at across the Bureau, we also do things like financing the federal operations. So last year we conducted over 238 auctions, raising $8.1 trillion. And so when you see things like the number of Treasury securities that have been issued, or you see that payments have been made, or you see things reported on the federal deficit, that's all information that's coming from our Bureau. And it was really apparent during the government shutdown how really critical we are, not only to the functioning of the government, but also the functioning of the economy as a whole. Because if we're not doing these things, like raising the money to finance the government operations, collecting the money, or making those payments, it has a significant impact on the economy.
So, Dave, regarding your duties and responsibilities, what are your three top challenges that you face in your current role, and how have you sought to address them?
Well, I think that there are a number of challenges that I think we as a bureau face that are being faced across government. I think it's fair to say that budgets are going to remain tight for the foreseeable future. I think that demographics are changing significantly with the aging of the workforce. I also think that technology is evolving very rapidly. And our bureau really is at the forefront of many of those things. And I'll give you an example. I mentioned the important payments that we make. About 3 years ago, we started an initiative called the All Electronic Initiative. And at that time, roughly 80% of all payments were being made electronically. Well, today, close to 98% of those benefit payments are being made electronically. And that's had a significant operational impact on the organization. We were producing close to 200 million checks a year. This current year, we're estimating we're going to probably produce about 80 million checks. So we went through a process where we had to actually close payment facilities. And I think if this had been something that happened 15 years ago, it would have been a much more difficult process to go through as an organization. In this situation, of the 160 people who were impacted, over half of them retired because they were retirement eligible. At the same time, we were very successful at placing the remaining of the employees and making sure that they had some place to land at the end of the process. But this is an intersection of technology changed. You can make payments electronically more easily today. Secondly, the demographics in the workforce have changed such that when you make these kinds of fundamental changes within the organization, you have a different dynamic than you would have had 20 years ago. And third, these were driven in large measure to reduce budgets. You know, it costs us over a dollar to produce a paper check. It costs us less than 10 cents to issue an electronic payment. So we were able to save, this initiative is going to save close to $1 billion over the course of the next 10 years. So it's a very good sort of looking at the environment that we live in as a whole. We're providing government better by providing electronic payments. At the same time, as a bureau, we need to be very cognizant of those changing dynamics so that we can operate more efficiently as a government agency. So I think that's one of the real issues and that's one of the examples I would give in looking strategically about where we need to be as an organization going forward and spending our time really thinking about those things carefully in advance of the significant changes happening.
Well, along with the challenges that you've encountered, Dave, what surprised you the most since taking the current leadership role that you're in?
Well, I don't think you can underestimate how hard federal employees work. And, you know, we have, as a bureau, we went through this major consolidation in the past year. It could be significantly disruptive to the workplace. And I think the thing that was really been quite remarkable to me is, despite this really significant change going on within the organization, our employees showed up every day and were committed to getting the job done for the American people. So, the example I often think of is, the very important payments I spoke about earlier. There was 24 inches of snow in Kansas City, and we had a group of employees who on that weekend rented hotel rooms in anticipation of the snowstorm so that they could be nearby the facility the next morning to get in there and make sure those payments got out. It's that kind of dedication on their own dime, by the way. I mean, this was something which was they did out of their own personal time and responsibility. When we have important information that needs to get out, you know, the dedication of the federal workforce to come in on the weekends and make sure those things get done, I think has been quite remarkable to me in the face of no awards, budget freezes, furloughs, the commitment to excellence and the commitment to making sure that we fulfill these really important government functions has really been quite remarkable to me. And it's really been great to see that we do have that kind of workforce that's prepared to do those kinds of things.
Dave, given your experience, what are the characteristics of an effective leader? And what lessons have you learned and brought to shape the new culture of this recently created bureau?
You know, a leader really has to be very, in some cases, have to take oftentimes difficult action but necessary action. And I'll talk a little bit about the consolidation and the timeline there. In September of 2011, my boss, the assistant secretary, came and said, I want you to think about consolidating the two bureaus. And I will tell you, that wasn't probably the first thing we thought he was going to talk to us about, nor probably the most popular thing. And so we sat down, and the reason why we did that and had that conversation in September was to we recognized that the budget environment was going to become increasingly difficult, and that we looked at the two independent bureaus and said, if we have to sustain long-term budget cuts, are we going to be able to continue to function? Can we survive in this new environment where 5, 6, or 7% budget cuts are occurring? And I think we were concerned, and I think we felt as though, as two independent entities, we would have a difficult time continuing to fulfill our mission-critical functions. And so we looked at it initially really as a budget exercise. How could we reduce costs? I think the thing that most surprised me in that process, though, has been the budget reductions have been significant. We're now, we have identified close to $100 million of savings, which is about 20% of our appropriated budget on an annual basis from our 2010 level. So we really have reduced our costs significantly. But what's really, I think, surprised me is that we've thought about ourselves differently. We've reimagined what the organization can do. So when you look at the legacy missions of the two organizations, you would see language which would say, we're here to provide services. We're here to provide payment services or financing services or debt collection services. When you look at the mission of the new organization, it's about transforming government. It's about changing the way the government does some of these back office operations and improving financial management across government. And in that, I think, while we've had experienced these significant reductions, we've also been able to take many significant steps forward on really improving the way government delivers services. I think that as difficult as the environment has been, sometimes in those challenges, opportunities emerge. And I think we've had some really good successes of taking advantage of many of those opportunities.
What are the strategic priorities of the Bureau of the Fiscal Service? We will ask Dave Liebrich, its commissioner, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can DoD improve its acquisition processes? Check out the latest IBM Center report, 8 Actions to Improve Defense Acquisition. The authors emphasize the urgency of acquisition reform in DoD, given budgetary constraints and security challenges, finding that DoD will need to gain every possible efficiency while resisting the temptation to buy defense on the cheap. This report continues the IBM Center's interest in better understanding and improving the federal government acquisition process. Download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dave Liebrich, Commissioner of the Bureau of the Fiscal Service within the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Also joining us from IBM is Roxanne Ulrich. So, Dave, how has the consolidation of two distinct organizations marked by unique missions and different cultures transpired? What are some of the challenges you face, and how have you sought to address those challenges?
Going back a little bit to the timeline, I mentioned September of 2011, and when we first started looking at this effort, by February 2012, we announced the effort publicly in the budget, and by October of 2012, we had actually executed the consolidation. We had actually come together as a bureau, and I think one of the challenges, and I think we did some things very, very well, and that I think in retrospect, as I look back, one of them was that we were very transparent about what we were doing. When we knew something, we said we knew it. When we didn't know something, we said we didn't know it. I personally went out and met with every employee and talked about the way the consolidation was going about and where we were headed as an organization. I think we did a very good job of focusing on what our new mission and vision was. We spent a lot of time around that. In fact, I have a card that I carry around with me, and every employee has, which talks about that mission and vision and then has more narrative on the back of the card, which talks about why we're doing what we're doing. We got this idea from Sony, who in the 1950s had looked at their organization, and they sat down and they talked about what they wanted to be. And at that time, people may remember that Japan wasn't really known for producing high-quality products. And they sat down and they said, we want to transform the way the world looks at Japan and the way they look at electronics. And they wrote a fairly mission statement around that. And I think it's fair to say that Sony had a very significant impact on how people viewed Japan and how they viewed electronics and the work that Sony does. And we sat down and we said, well, how do we want people to think about us in 3 to 5 years? And I think we did a pretty good job of in 10 years. And I think we did a pretty good job of going through that process. We also did 8 major reorganizations within the organization and sort of, you know, bringing the two units together. We got the organizational structure in place. We set up a special site called One Fiscal where employees could ask questions, and we would have frequently asked questions responded to. We had numerous communications. I do something called a What's Up, which I do every two or three weeks, in which I talk about things that are going on in the organization. That became increasingly important during the consolidation period. We had our public affairs office also set up a communication mechanism to sort of give folks an opportunity to see exactly what was going on, when and where. So I think in that sense, I feel, you know, we were pretty good at managing the change. Now, that's not to say that employees always were happy with what we did. That's one of the challenges of leadership, is sometimes you're going to do things which aren't altogether popular. But it's really important to have a clear sense of where you're trying to head and strategically where you're trying to position the organization. I think that was sort of the first phase, was actually, you know, consolidation itself. Second phase is integration, and you look at sustainability, and then ultimately you look at sort of optimization of your organization. Where we are right now is sort of that remaining that integration phase. How do we get all the policies and practices to align with one another? How do we bring the cultures together? How do we manage in multiple locations, something we perhaps have not done previously? And so we have a lot of work still to do in that area. And I would say we probably have not done, my own view is, we need to get back to that very strong communication mechanism of giving people very clear insights into when something's happening and why. I think many of us, we felt as though we were on a sprint for the last year. And now it's time to sort of step back and say, how do we really make sure that these two organizations come together? We have an effort underway right now is to reexamine our values. And we sent a survey out to all of our employees, and we are doing focus groups, and we'll sit down and sort of see what are the right values that we want to have for this new organization going forward. How do we invest in our people? You know, my own view is one of the most important things that we can do in terms of the integration phase of this is making sure people feel valued. And as I mentioned about the card, one of the comments we have on there is we want to be an organization that's recognized as having experts in our field. Well, in order to do that, you have to invest in training. You have to make sure then, so we have a credentialing program that we have underway to look at what credentials do we think are necessary for us to be seen as the real experts in payments and collections and accounting. We even have a certification program now for call center personnel so that they get certified as certified call center personnel, CPA training, and government financial managers. So we're project managers, another very important one. We have over 130 project managers in the organization, certified project managers. So it's that sort of, you know, guaranteeing each employee 40 hours of training. And we can do that because of the consolidation in some ways has given us more flexibility as we've gotten smaller and our budget's gotten smaller. We've given us a little bit more flexibility through the consolidation to be able to fulfill those commitments to our workers and say, we really do want to make sure you have the skills to do your job well. And this becomes increasingly important, as I mentioned earlier, about the demographics, where so much of the workforce is about ready to retire. I think OPM issued a report recently, said, you know, in the next 2 or 3 years, 30% of the federal workforce will be eligible for retirement. That baby boom generation is going through. And I think for us, one of the things we look at is we say, you know, you can't stop hiring. I mean, you've got to bring new people within the organization. You've got to make sure that when you bring them in, you give them the skills and the resources and the training to be successful at their jobs. So I think that's one of the things as we're looking forward in the next year of the kinds of things that need to happen to appreciate the full merits of the consolidation of the two bureaus.
Dave, while budgetary pressure may have been a primary reason for consolidating, and you talked much about that earlier, there will no doubt be increasing challenges in the future to find cost savings and efficiencies in how you administer your programs and carry out your missions. To that end, would you briefly outline your strategic vision for the Bureau and your key strategic priorities over the next few years?
We talk about lead, transform, and deliver when we think about the things that we're doing. And I would say that we don't anticipate that the budget pressures are going to get any less in the coming years. So we now are, you know, looking out and sort of what are the next kinds of things that we need to be looking at in order to be sustainable longer term. And in that environment, you know, I think we've also kind of positioned the Bureau in a very good place because other government agencies are experiencing the exact same thing. In fact, one of the reasons why I think we've been successful in some of our initiatives is the other government agencies are feeling the exact same pressures that we did. And what you're seeing is them having the pressures to focus on mission. Mm-hmm. And how do you sustain or how do you protect your core mission responsibilities? And quite often the back office operations are not part of that core mission. And so the pressure is within those agencies right now, or how do you deliver the sort of the infrastructure less expensively, the admin, the overhead. And that's what we do. So when I've gone out and spoken to CFOs and the community, there's a lot of receptivity to the kinds of things that we're talking about, of centralizing some of the services and looking at shared services as options for agencies. And we'll be doing much more of that in the coming months, of really trying to emphasize that for other government agencies. I will say that, you know, for us, one of the reasons why we were able to function well in the budget environment is that we really looked hard at our data centers. We went from 5 data centers down to 2. We went from 4 payment centers to 2. We reduced our facilities footprint and reduced costs there. We moved some of our functions to shared services. And we moved to electronics and a lot of things. So I think that, you know, there are lessons there for other government agencies, that there are opportunities to reduce your costs by looking at those things. But also, as I pointed out before, on a more macro level, of looking at more centralized services is another way to really reduce those costs.
Dave, your bureau is the primary disperser of payments to individuals and businesses on behalf of the federal government, SSA and VBA benefits, federal income tax return payments. How are you modernizing the Bureau's payment operations and systems? What key initiatives are you pursuing in this area? And what are the intended benefits of these initiatives?
So the major one I mentioned earlier was the all-electronic on the payment side, and continuing to move forward on that. In fact, I mentioned that we will have about 80 million checks that we'll produce this year. Interesting enough, about half of those are going to be tax refund checks, one-time payments. So in the past, the largest consumer of check payments was the Social Security beneficiaries. Yes. Well, in this past year, now the largest single consumer of check will be the Internal Revenue Service on tax refunds. So we want to try to make as much effort as we can to kind of get that number down. For example, if someone is already receiving a government payment electronically, why not receive your tax refund electronically? So, you know, we can try to do a little bit in that area. I think we also have an initiative underway called our post-payment initiative, and that's to really look at our how we analyze the payments and we account for the payments on the back end. In that process, kind of interestingly, we're finding that we have the potential to bring better data analytics to our payments processes. The example I'll give is that it can provide payment history in a much easier way than we have in the past. So, for example, if you're a Social Security beneficiary and you've been receiving a payment to your bank account for the last 10 years, and all of a sudden that's now been changed to become a payment to a prepaid debit card, you might flag that transaction and say, is there potentially fraud there, that someone has actually somehow tried to redirect that payment in a place it shouldn't be? At the same time, we'll have the ability to look at and say, if 5 payments are going to the same address, is that something that maybe we should, you know, pause and look at? If there are 5 payments from 6 different agencies, you know, or 6 different agencies going to a same address, is that something? Now, there are some, oftentimes there's very legitimate reasons why that will happen. Multi-generational families will live in one place. There's representative payees who actually administer payments on behalf of others. So it doesn't necessarily mean that there's something that's not exactly right, but it may give you some indication of saying maybe we want to pay a little bit more attention to some of those transactions. And make sure that we're comfortable that they're being paid to the right people. So that's in the payments area. That's one of the ongoing areas. In the collections area, we have some work going on where we're looking at ways you can make it easier for individuals to pay the government. You know, right now, most people can use online banking to pay certain entities like your utilities payments and the like. Well, why shouldn't you be able to pay the government that way and use the online banking service to do that? In addition, we're looking at, you know, payment mechanisms at national parks and, can you use a prepaid card or can you use an e-wallet type transaction in much in the same way that you might be able to do that in your private life. Mm-hmm. So making it easier to interact with the government in the same way that people interact with themselves or with other private entities in their personal lives.
I was wondering, as a follow-up, the Bureau's payment information repository, how does it make government payments more transparent?
Well, it's an internal repository. So really what that is right now is, again, it gets it back a little bit at my point earlier about the ability to do better data analytics with the information that's coming in. But right now it's designed to serve as to make sure you have one repository of information so that when people want to know, when we all want to know internally or the agencies about what payments have been made and the information surrounding those payments, we have a centralized source for that. But ultimately, it will lead us or allow us to do better analytics around some of the payment data. Like I mentioned before, are there unusual trends in the payments? Are there things that we maybe want to be paying attention to?
Dave, your bureau administers the world's largest government funds collection system through a network of more than 10,000 fiscal institutions. To improve your revenue collection services, the Bureau seems to continue to advance the Collections and Cash Management Modernization Initiative. Would you tell us more about that initiative and how it will lead to cost savings, eliminate duplicate functions, and simplify systems? And are there any other initiatives being pursued in that area?
So fortunately, we had a major initiative that's concluded a little over a year ago on the cash and collections modernization effort that did actually rationalize our collections processes and will, as a result, save around $60 million a year by doing that. And that was that we felt very good about that. We brought that on budget, on time, and concluded that phase of sort of our collections. Part of that also in the collections area in the past 2 years, we've moved 1.4 million taxpayers from making paper payments to electronic payments through our EFTPS, our electronic tax payment system. Businesses are the largest payer of taxes, and so most of our collections come through the business payroll taxes and the like. Mm-hmm. Individuals sometimes have to pay quarterly taxes, estimated taxes. And many times, some of us will remember, you have to clip a coupon or you cut a coupon and you send it in. But we'd like more individuals to be doing that electronically. And you can do that through the EFTPS system. So it's a little bit easier to manage. And you can pre-position payments that says, I want that payment to go on January 15th. In advance, and you can set the amount along the way. So you're making that more accessible to private individuals rather than simply just companies. But as I mentioned, we had 1.4 million small businesses move to that in the last 2 years, significantly removing paper from the system in a significant way. I also mentioned the sort of the next generation of looking at how can we make collections more easy for government agencies and for individuals, and things like the electronic wallet, things like online banking. I think our efforts that will further modernize our collections processes.
How does the Bureau of the Fiscal Service transform the way the federal government manages its finances? We will ask Dave Liebrich, Commissioner of the Bureau of the Fiscal Service, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Government leaders and managers face major challenges today, including fiscal austerity, citizen expectation, the pace of technology and innovation, and a new role for governance. These challenges influence how government executives lead today, but more importantly, how they can be prepared for tomorrow. The IBM Center report, Six Trends Driving Change in Government, offers a path forward for government executives responding to the ever-increasing complexity and challenges they face today. Download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dave Liebrich, Commissioner of the Bureau of the Fiscal Service within the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Also joining us from IBM is Roxanne Ulrich. So, Dave, given the fact that you, in the last 18 months you've been doing a lot of things, I'm wondering, are there any new initiatives within the last couple of months that you've been pursuing?
In late January, we really had quite an exciting period at the Bureau where the President of the State of the Union address announced the MyRA, and that's a new retirement security primarily directed toward new savers. It's a Roth IRA type account. And I think we feel that's going to be very appealing to try to encourage people to save, as well as give employers, large and small, who presently might not offer a retirement account to their employees. And it has some income restrictions on it, as do the Roth IRAs. I believe those numbers are somewhere around $129,000 per individual and $191,000 for a couple. And I think this is part of the president's effort to really encourage savings in the country. We at the Bureau have the opportunity to actually build the infrastructure to support this. And this is not something particularly new. We run the savings bonds programs, for example, and a program called Treasury Direct, where over 50 million people actually are account holders of savings bonds and Treasury Direct, in which they do have government securities and things like savings bonds that they have. And so this is a very kind of a natural extension of the things that we already do. and in the coming months we'll be helping build that infrastructure. The second thing that happened in that week was we issued for the first time in 16 years something called a floating rate note, successfully auctioned around $15 billion. And that's been very popular, too, with the investment community. And that's usually larger investors are the ones who are buying those, but individuals can buy them as well. And that's a culmination of a lot of hard work within the Bureau to make sure that those auctions have been successful. And then finally, we implemented a new reporting system, financial reporting system for the government as a whole called GTAS. And that's an effort to have agencies report their financial information so that we can use that to compile reports to the Congress as well as make publicly available information to that people want to know about expenditures within the government.
Now I'd like to turn to the accounting area. In particular, your primary responsibility or critical responsibility is to maintain the federal government's set of accounts. So what are you doing to modernize the federal government's central accounting and reporting system? And the second part of the question is, how does data transparency factor into this?
So the Bureau is also responsible for producing something called the Financial Report of the United States Government done annually. And that's really a compilation of the financial activity for the past fiscal year. We use a lot of the central systems that we have to compile that information, asking the agencies to report that information. It's not an easy process to do that. You can imagine it as an entity as large as the federal government. And so things like GTAS, which I mentioned a second ago, are parts of our effort to make that process go more smoothly and giving agencies better data. But I do think that there is a more general question around data transparency, and that's one of the new strategic goals we have for the organization is to make financial information a public good, that it can be consumable by the public and that we try to do the best we can to give the public better access to financial information in the government. Now, there's lots of challenges with that. And we've sat down and thought about, you know, where we think we need to be in the next 3 to 5 and 10 years on that. Part of the challenge is that you have to have data standardization. And right now, there's different systems across government that provide data in different forms, and there's not oftentimes a unique identifier of that information. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in there. There's also over 47 different core financial systems across government. So the ability to extract information or get information is complex. Different systems, different functionality within those systems. And so one of the things that we're looking at is how do you simplify that infrastructure and have fewer core financial systems, standardize the information so that when you attempt to extract the information, it's easier to extract it and more usable on the other end. I think one of the underlying premises of this is that we don't know all the uses of the data, and nor should we try to predict all the potential uses for the data. And one example I would give is, you know, that NOAA provides weather information, and the National Weather Channel uses that information. And interestingly enough, advertisers use that information to decide what advertisements they want to run on a National Weather Channel. When one was thinking about this information that's being provided by the government to the private sector, you're not exactly sure how it would be used. GPS is another good example. That's government data which is being provided, and private companies are using the data to do things like using GPS systems and the like that have all improved the quality of our life significantly. I'm not sure how I ever drove without a GPS prior to that. But it's really important that this is government providing important and useful information to the American public, but also providing in a way that someone, if they can use that information to benefit the quality of life, they can do that. And so we're not exactly sure what all the uses of the data might be for our financial purposes, but we do know that people have interest in it. And we want to make sure that we we drive the effort forward that's going to make it more usable. You know, one of the questions is the information machine readable? Well, lots of government information today is not machine readable, so it makes it hard to do analysis around it. And those are some of the things that, as we're looking out in the future, that we want to play more of a driving role in making that possible.
Dave, your bureau serves as the government's central debt collection agency, managing the government's delinquent debt portfolio owed to the U.S. government. Would you tell us more about your efforts to enhance fiscal services debt collection efforts using business analytics specifically, and how you're developing the skills and systems as well as cultivating a data-driven culture within the bureau?
So a couple things in that. Last year, we collected $7 billion in delinquent debt owed to the federal government, which is about $1 billion more than the previous year. About $500 million of that increase, that billion-dollar increase, is a direct result of us doing things differently in the last year about how we actually work the delinquent debt portfolio. And one of those ways, I'll give you an example, is in the past, there would be something called a partial match. If my wife had a loan in her maiden name and she was getting paid in her married name, when that file went to go match, that's what we do, we match the files, it would kick it back and say, we're not really sure that they're the same person. And we would send that file back to the agencies and say, would you figure this out? Are they the same person? Because agencies don't have resources, this is not a core competency, oftentimes that cleanup didn't take place. This past year, we decided that we would do the analytics on that, and we would score the match. We would say, what's the likelihood that it is that it's the same person, that my wife on her maiden name and her married name is in because it's the same address? And the last year, we were able to collect close to additional $300 million through that process of simply just us doing using analytics and doing better matching to increase collections. In addition, in the last year, we've done a very extensive outreach to the states. The unemployment insurance compensation funds are federal monies administered by the states. Well, there's oftentimes overpayments or fraudulent payments in that process. And in getting them into the debt collection program, we were able to recover close to $200 million on behalf of the states of unemployment funds that were either misdirected, mispaid, or inappropriately paid. And we've had several, now we have close to 37 states who are participating in that program, with several more we want to bring on in the coming year. You know, that's an example of us looking at our job differently and of not just simply saying we're providing something. We're actually going out and very aggressively saying, how can we make government operate better? And so the Department of Labor has been very happy with the program, as has been the states. In fact, two governors, one governor in particular, said that the solvency of his state fund is directly attributable to the work that we've been doing in order to assist them in recover funds. So it's the kind of thing where, you know, we can do things smarter and very effectively. I would say also on the issue about analytics, because I know a lot of government agencies are looking at that right now. It's not easy. And I think that if you look at sort of the skill set that we have in government, there are not a lot of people who have that background. In fact, it's a skill that's very much in demand in the private sector today. So we're competing against that, and it's not easy. I would say in our debt collection area, though, we started with kind of baby steps. I mean, we basically went out and hired two or three very good people to start the effort, and then brought in more very good people. And so we have a very small group of a very small team of about six or seven people who are doing the data analytics and are really advancing the organization about how we think about data and the underlying information that we have. But I would say initially, when we made the initial hires, their contribution wasn't so much about data analytics. It was about a way of thinking about things. And it had a really powerful impact in the organization about being more rigorous and more analytic and more analytical on how we look at things. Now, they've now moved more toward the actual data analytics and actually, you know, some more sophisticated things. But the initial phase was the most important phase, was bringing really good people to help you think about things potentially differently.
And the federal government makes trillions of dollars in payments every year. And as you mentioned, unfortunately, there are instances where the government makes payments that are improper. Would you tell us about your efforts to reduce improper payments in the federally funded programs? And how does the Do Not Pay Business Center factor into your work in that area?
So there are about an estimated over $100 billion of improper payments. It's important to understand what that means, because I think that sometimes there's the conclusion that people draw is that means that there's that money being paid to people who shouldn't be getting it, and there's fraud, waste, and abuse that's attached to that. That does happen. But at the same time, what oftentimes happens is it's about a payment that doesn't have proper documentation, or it's a payment that has been misdirected. And so, or there perhaps had not been appropriate income eligibility screening done on the payment. There are a number of reasons why these things happen, but the example I best would give is if there's a health care payment that's made to a doctor and he makes a claim for $10,000 but only has documentation for $8,000, the $10,000 is considered improper payment, even though the documentation was there for eight of the ten. So sometimes the number can be a little bit misleading overall, but there's some very important issues here, which is you have to have integrity in your payment system. And so the government shouldn't be paying deceased people, plain and simple. While that's not a large percentage of that $100 billion, it's a very small percentage of it, It doesn't give people confidence that government's doing what it should be doing if there's stories about paying people, dead people. I would say, though, that the Bureau, we last year reclaimed about $13 billion of payments that were misdirected or improper. And how that happens is if it's identified that the payment went to the wrong bank account or alternatively the person had been deceased, we recover those funds. And so we've been very successful at that as a Bureau of that aspect of it. But we can do more. And the Do Not Pay Center is really about making sure that we're matching our payment files against particular data sources, things like the deceased person's, the death master file was called, and making sure that if someone's on that and they shouldn't be getting a government payment, that we can capture that, or excluded parties list of someone who shouldn't be doing business with the government, if we shouldn't be making payments to prisoners, for example. So the Do Not Pay Center right now is really in the process of building those data sources, those sources that we can match against, making sure we have appropriate privacy protections in place. And that's a really important issue here, is you can't just randomly start matching data against each other. You have to have the right agreements in place and the right protections in place to make sure that you're doing it the right way. We've had a lot of success in the debt collection program of doing it the right way, where I think we've been very careful about not exceeding our authority or taking approaches that may be too heavy-handed. We're using similar caution here that we want to make sure that we're protecting citizens' privacy and that we're doing it in the right way.
Dave, what is the Treasury Direct program, and can you tell us how you're enhancing the platform?
So Treasury Direct is individuals can buy Treasury securities. Now, the way I mentioned those $8 trillion that we raise every year, most of that money is raised through primary dealers. There's a very large number of banks who participate in our auctions. And then they sometimes sell those securities to other people. So they act as kind of a central location. And you as an individual can go to some of those banks and say, I'd like to buy a Treasury security from them, or a broker and buy it. But the source of that usually is those primary dealers. But you as an individual can also set up an account called a Treasury Direct account with Treasury and buy those securities directly, and they're held by Treasury. And the system that we have in place right now is quite old, and it does need to be updated. We know that. And so we're looking at an effort to modernize the interfaces that we have so that individuals, when they're interacting with us, feel like they're interacting with their bank or their mutual fund, and having the same look and feel and the same ability to get information in the same way. Today, that's not exactly what we have. We need to do better on that. But we do have an effort underway to actually try to address that in the coming months.
Dave, would you tell us more about the government agency investment services efforts to offer specialized investments and borrowing programs for government entities and agencies? And how do you ensure that it meets both statutory requirements and customers' needs?
So this is probably not one of the better known things that we do, but it is really important. We manage, for example, the Social Security Trust Fund, and those are part of the investment services that we provide, and the Highway Trust Fund, for example. And we're very proud of the work that's done in that area, and we always talk about 16 years of clean audit opinions and making sure that we can account for the public debt down to the penny. We also then in that same area offer something called, it's artfully named, SLUGS program, which is a state and local government series. And it's a little bit technical, but it's really when governments go out, local governments raise money, they can't arbitrage those funds. They need to make sure that they're not paying one interest rate, but investing in a different interest rate for tax purposes. And so we offer an option for state and local governments that they can use our program to make sure that they don't have that problem when they have excess funds. And that's a very important initiative for many of the state and local governments that helps them. But again, the management of those investment accounts is very important, as people can imagine.
So, Dave, we've mentioned that the era of fiscal constraint, government agencies are looking for new and better ways of doing things, efficiencies, cost effectiveness. And one of the push there is shared services. What are you folks doing in the area of shared services, and how does your Administrative Resource Center, ARC, factor into this effort?
I think we're probably the only bureau or agency that has shared services as part of our mission, that we clearly view that as important, something important that we do. And so we provide shared services in a number of areas, whether it be in travel, procurement, accounting, HR, and IT. And as I mentioned, we have 188 customers that we provide those services. The important piece here, though, is that we really do believe that this is where government needs to be going. And so we actually work closely with the other shared service providers and trying to understand what is the demand out there for shared services and that how we collectively can meet that demand. One area that we've spent a lot of time, I mentioned earlier about the core financial systems. You know, the example I give is that we upgraded the financial system that ARC uses for $300,000 per customer. Now, you know, when people know about these ERP systems, that's, you know, no one would, usually it's multiples and multiples of that to do that. But what it shows is the power of the model, which is the headache for upgrading that system resided on ARC. ARC worked closely with the vendor, understands the product very well, has very good project management skills, isn't relearning something, you know, isn't learning something for the first time or relearning something that they had forgotten from long ago. And therefore, that project came in under budget, on time, in a way where, you know, if you're a federal agency and you're not used to doing these kinds of things, there are many examples across the federal government where they've had, you know, very difficult implementations and costly implementations. So I mentioned the value as it relates to data. You know, that is, fewer systems allows you to extract the data and standardize the data more easily. But there's also significant cost savings involved, and administration of the systems is sizable. And so I think that, you know, we're out there talking to the other shared service providers, and we're talking about what agencies are doing, what they need to be doing over the course of the next 10 years. So, for example, if an agency just put in a new system, you wouldn't expect them to have to move to a shared service provider in the next year. But when they're looking down the road 5, 6, 7 years, you want to say, look, one of the options you really need to be considering is, are these federal shared service providers a viable option for you? And so the Bureau itself is in the middle of some really important work with HUD right now to look at their core financial system and assist them. And I think what that is, it's significant in the sense that in the past, the shared service providers have really primarily been small agencies. Mm-hmm. That have used the shared service providers because they couldn't afford to provide those things. I think what you're seeing now is more of a movement toward large agencies using the shared service model. That's not without challenges. I mean, how do you grow the business in the right way? How do you make sure you have appropriate governance and representation in that process? But I think it's the way the government needs to go in large measure. Now, the other example I'll give there is, you know, I talked to one CFO who said he spends 25% of his time on systems issues because he's dealing with his ERP and his core system. The CFO in my organization and my bureau spends none of her time on systems issues. She's spending her time on internal controls. She's spending her time on budget. She's spending her time on management and HR, the things that we want her to spend her time on, not on looking at what her core financial system is doing. So it's a very powerful model, and I think that example holds true in a number of areas, whether it be travel or procurement. There's lots of opportunity across government to do more.
What does the future hold for Treasury's Bureau of the Fiscal Service? We will ask Dave Liebrich, its commissioner, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. In a world inundated with all kinds of information, timely, relevant, and more predictive data can drive better decision-making. Law enforcement agencies are at the forefront in leveraging data and using innovative software to generate predictions that help police prevent crime. What is predictive policing? How can using analytics make us safer? Check out the IBM Center report, Predictive Policing, Preventing Crime with Data and Analytics by Jen Bochner, and find out. Download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. What do agency leaders need to know about the federal acquisition process? What are some of the key federal procurement trends? And how can agency leaders overcome today's acquisition challenges? Check out the new Center report, A Guide for Agency Leaders on Federal Acquisition, by Trevor Brown, and find out. The report offers practical recommendations for improving federal acquisition. Download your free copy of A Guide for Agency Leaders on Federal Acquisition at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dave Liebrich, Commissioner of the Bureau of the Fiscal Service within the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Also joining us from IBM is Roxanne Ulrich. Dave, given the very unique government-wide mission of fiscal service, the Bureau interacts and forges partnerships with virtually every federal agency, as well as many private sector entities. Would you elaborate on these partnerships, and how are you leveraging partnerships to improve management operations?
And that really is an important aspect because we are, in some cases, an option for an agency, but in other cases, we're the only provider. So, you know, we need to make sure that, and I think that's one of the things, one of the lessons I would have learned over the time. We've gone through a number of modernization efforts in the last 5 years as a bureau. And I think one of the lessons I would have learned there is we needed to spend more time up front with the agencies talking about their needs. I think that oftentimes, and this is, I don't think we're necessarily unique to this, is that we would build a system and say, you need to use the system and figure out how to use it. We need to do a much better job and going on a going forward basis of talking to agencies about what their needs are and then trying to build a system to fit those needs. Part of that is that I do CFO and DCFO visits every year with the agencies, and we go out and talk about what we're doing. And I take my entire senior team with me because I want them to hear from the agencies that there's things that we're doing that we're not doing that we could be doing better. I do a blog, and one of the first blog postings was feedback is a gift, and that we really need to sort of have a mindset that says, you know, when you get feedback, good or bad, you need to understand why someone feels that way, and see what you might be able to do about it. And I think these visits that we do at the CFOs are an attempt to do that, of really trying to do a better job of hearing from them. And we've heard in many cases that we've implemented systems that have made it difficult for the agencies. In many cases, we've tried to do workarounds, those things. But I think we would have been better served to start from the beginning and sort of say, you know, what are the requirements and what can we do to make it more accessible and usable by you? I think, for example, where we and recently were very successful, the IPERIA, which was the do not pay legislation that passed in the end of 2012, had 6 months to implement a provision of that. We could have just said to the agencies, you figure it out. But because of our experience with debt collection, we put in place a solution that had very minimal impact on the agencies that was very similar to what we do on debt collection, about the ability for them just to send the file to us and we'll do the matching. I think that was an example of us coming up with solutions that really did meet the needs of the agencies, gave them something that didn't cost them much money. It wasn't very difficult for them because we really thought through hard about what was the best way to do it. And we need to do more of that when we're doing the implementation of things.
Dave, turning just to the role of the CFO, given the critical importance fiscal information plays in mission and program delivery, how do you think the role of the federal fiscal executive or the CFO has evolved to become more of a strategic business partner across the services? And what would you view as the key characteristics of an effective federal fiscal executive?
Well, there was a session where they talked about the impact of the CFO Act. And I think that by and large, everyone would say it's been very successful at bringing more discipline and rigor into the CFO and understanding about what the CFO needs to do. I think, though, in the last 3 or 4 years, the CFO role has become even more difficult in many ways. Because I think if you go back in 2008 or so, there was enormous amount of emphasis on spending money, stimulus money. It was a Recovery Act and stimulus money was spent. And agencies really were about how can we get the money out as quickly as we can and the like. Well, shortly thereafter, not unexpectedly, the attention came to, do you have controls? And what's the outcome? You know, what are you getting for that money? Then there was a very abrupt end, which sort of said, no, stop spending money. You know, we don't want you to spend any more money at all. Then I think where we are right now is CFOs looking and saying, well, if I've got this much money, how do I protect my core mission? And the senior leadership in every agency is saying, I want you to find savings. I don't want to have more costs and overhead. I want to be able, how do I protect my programs, my really important programs along the way? So I think the CFO is now in a position to sort of saying, I really need to figure out how do I run my operation more efficiently and have less costs spent on overhead. And that's where I think we as a bureau, I think we step into that space relatively nicely. I mean, but I see that trend continuing. I also see the trend in continuing that –